furniture here again. So this is Memorial Day weekend, and tomorrow is officially observed as Memorial Day. The very name, Memorial Day, identifies it as a national day of remembrance, a day of remembrance, a day to remember and to honor those of this and previous generations who died in war and other conflicts in service to our country. The irony, though, is that in practice, the significance of this day is increasingly being not remembered, along with the personal identities of those of earlier generations whom it seeks to honor. How many of you can remember the names of those who served, for example, in the Civil War, other than a few major names? They come and they go. But remembering is a crucial part of a nation, the functioning of a nation, of any society and any family of people. Just last Saturday, for example, we had a memorial service here for a departed loved one, and a number of you attended other such memorial services in the area or in Michigan that same day as well. The biblical book of Ecclesiastes talks a lot about remembering and not being remembered. The opening section speaks of earlier things and people, as well as those who come after us, not being remembered. And the closing section of the book, of the body of the book, urges us to remember our Creator in the days of our youth with our end in view. In between, it also speaks of God remembering. God never forgets, even though we do. So I've titled our new series in Ecclesiastes, Living with the End in View. Living with the End in View. I went back and forth between this title and calling it Living with One Foot in the Grave. That's really a central idea of Ecclesiastes, and is certainly a bit more edgy and catchy. It has an edge to it, and Ecclesiastes is certainly a book with an edge. Everywhere you turn, it seems. So I'm using that title, that other title, for one of my sermon titles, but it doesn't quite capture all the end which Ecclesiastes has in view for living well. So for the whole series, I'm going with the less colorful title, Living with the End in View. Sorry about that, but I went for that for the sake of accuracy. If you can think of something catchier that is also accurate, I will be glad to hear of it, and I'll incorporate that. Well, by end, I have three things in mind. First, Ecclesiastes drives home the point that to get the most out of this life, we need to be keenly aware that our life in this life will soon end. Now, you may anticipate, if you're younger, that you've got a lot of years to live. You don't know that. And even if you do live the full allotment of years that a human being might live, that's pretty short, isn't it? When you think of it across the whole expanse of time. And when you're older, suddenly you realize your days are just about gone. Where did they go? They're so quick. Well, that's one aspect of the end. Remembering that our life is short, the end is near in that sense. Second, by the time it's done meditating on the possibilities and limitations of this life, Ecclesiastes brings us to the end of the matter, as it calls it, at the end of the book, to the bottom line conclusion to be drawn for how we're to live, and I'm going to wait on that till we get there. And third, Ecclesiastes affirms that what grounds it all is that in the end, God will bring every deed into judgment, every secret thing, whether good or evil. And Ecclesiastes alludes to that from time to time throughout the book, pointing toward that final end. With the end ever in view, Ecclesiastes prepares us to die, and it teaches us to live. In order to live, you've got to be prepared to die. Ecclesiastes 1:1 begins, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. The title preacher here occurs 7 times in the book, at the beginning and about in the middle and then at the end. The Hebrew term comes from the word meaning to gather or to assemble. The book gets its name from this. Ecclesiastes is the Greek, comes from the Greek term about the gathering together of people. The Hebrew term comes from the word meaning to gather or assemble, as I mentioned. And it describes, or this term, its form of it, describes one who is addressing the gathering. There's no inherent religious function in the term, and so translating it as the preacher may be reading something into it a bit too much. And yet, the book clearly reveals the preacher's pastoral-like concern for the people. So I'm content with the preacher, and I can identify with that. The preacher, that sounds good to me. I can say the preacher every week here now. The preacher says this, the preacher says that, and get away with it, right? Ecclesiastes 12, verses 9 and 10, describes the preacher here in this book as a wise man who taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. It says he sought to find words of delight and uprightly wrote the words of truth. That's the book we now know as Ecclesiastes and have before us. It's described in chapter 12 and verse 11 as having been ultimately given by the one shepherd, that is by God. And that becomes very significant when it comes at the end and the place that it comes. The one shepherd, God. The other two descriptions of the preacher in verse 1, the son of David and the king of Israel, or king of Jerusalem, along with other self-descriptions of the preacher in the book, are clearly meant to identify him with King Solomon, renowned for his wisdom, for his great wealth, his building projects, and in violation of God's clear instruction concerning kings in Deuteronomy, his many wives. Not a good thing. See, people who are given the gift of wisdom can sometimes be very foolish. And unfortunately, Solomon was in a good part of his life, despite all the wisdom God had given to him. Now, whether the preacher is actually Solomon or wise man purposely taking on the persona of Solomon in order to instruct God's people, as preachers sometimes do, that's debated. But in either case, the result is the same. In the introduction, Ecclesiastes 1 and verses 1 through 11 confronts us with the prospect that our time in this life and whatever we gain in it by all our hard work will soon come to an end. Let that sink in. As the preacher develops this theme in the book of Ecclesiastes through a series of questions and explorations of life as it is, he's a realist, the preacher is, he points us beyond ourselves to the one whose ways alone endure forever. And that's a slowly emerging part of the book, but a very essential part, I think the fundamental part of where the preacher is going here. There's only one whose ways are forever, and we need to be hooked up with him. In verse 2, the preacher lays it out for us in a nutshell. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. Do you get the point there? That's the theme of his book. It's not all he has to say, but it's a central theme of the book. Everything in this life is utterly, the ESV translates temporary or vanity. I will use the word temporary. Temporary for this. Everything in this life is utterly temporary. Vanity has certain connotations to it that fit in some contexts, but are not fundamental to the word vanity, to the word, the Hebrew word here. The preacher repeats this statement, though, at the end of his investigations of this life in Ecclesiastes 12:8. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. So he frames the book with this statement. It's an emphatic statement that he wants to get across to us. It's a superlative expression of what it is. Vanity of vanities, the explanatory statement, all is vanity, and then the threefold repetition of the Hebrew word translated vanity, all emphasize the utter nature of this thing. The word hevel, that's the Hebrew word, literally means breath, vapor, which, and it comes from the vapor, which comes from the word, from breath. as on a cold day. Even the saying, the word itself, hevel, soft H, soft B, hevel, gives a sensation of breath. That's fundamental to it. But here and in the 35 other occurrences in Ecclesiastes, it has a figurative sense, most fundamentally temporary, transitory, and that's why I'm using the word here, and therefore elusive, which is another major aspect of the imagery that's meant here. It can also express other related ideas depending on the context. For example, vanity as the ESV translates it, meaningless as the NIV translates it, uselessness, futility, absurdity. But all of those fit certain contexts, sometimes just one or two different contexts, but not all of them. The underlying, bottom line meaning here, sense, is something that is transitory and so elusive. You can't catch it. Psalm 39, 5 through 6, verse 11, use the same word, havel. Behold, you have made my days, the psalmist talking to God. Behold, you have made my days a few handbreadths, and my lifetime is as nothing before you. Surely all mankind stands as a mere breath, a mere havel. Surely a man goes about as a shadow. That's another imagery that Ecclesiastes will use in parallel to havel. Surely as a breath, havel. They are in turmoil. Man heaps up wealth and does not know who will gather. Surely all mankind stands as a mere havel, breath. Psalm 144, verses 3 and 4. O Lord, what is man that you regard him? And that may be the sense, something that the Ecclesiastes is asking as well. What is man? What is all of this about? Or the son of man that you think of him. Man is like a breath, like a havel. His days are like a passing shadow. You see, this life is short. This life is very short. In the New Testament, James 4:14 says that we make certain plans and do this or that in our business or whatever. Yet, James tells us, you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist. That's another good translation of the word. James uses the equivalent to the Hebrew term here, havel. What is, for you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Think of this. How long does the mist, or the vapor of your breath on the early morning, it comes out? Is there, how long does it last? It's gone. Just a moment. Just the mere breath itself is there. It's real, but then it's gone. Shortness of life. When you were younger, when you were, Jake say, well, younger than that even, because Jake's kind of, he's 40 now, so he's past the time that you can be trusted, which was age 30 as some of us were growing up. That was the age. But when you were a teenager or in your early 20s or your later 20s, you lived, right, as though this life does not end. That's how you treated it. You lived for the moment with no thought for tomorrow. At least some of us did. Your perspective changes as you get older and you look back on it now, and you do agree, life, he's right. This life is short. It's very short. Isn't it right, Sharon? This life is short. Goes by in a blink of an eye. I can remember when Jeremy, our son, was about a year old or so, and we were moving into a new trailer. We upgraded from one trailer, moved into another one. It was a handyman special, and I had to rip out the rugs and everything and disinfect everything and put in new rugs and putting them in. And Jeremy is crawling around trying to poke his nose wherever I'm doing the hammering or this or that. He was engaged, but not in the way I wanted. But I remember those days, and I think back, my son Jeremy, that little, he's 40, turned 40 just, you know, this past month. And I'm wondering, where did it all go? Where did it all go? Life is short. If you don't believe that now, you will believe it later, especially when you're at the very end and you know it. Where did it all go? It's temporary and fleeting, and therefore this life is also elusive. It's elusive. It's hard to grasp onto, to grab hold of. You can't live long enough to understand what you need to understand to grab onto it, at least not on in your own devices, your own thinking, your own observations. When you were a little kid, did you ever try to catch the breath of your mouth on a cold morning? Maybe you didn't. I did. I tried to catch it and contain it and open up, and it's not there. You can't do it. Again, it's not only short, but it's elusive. You cannot contain it. You cannot grab it and control it. It's like the wind. You see the effects of it. You know where it's coming from, at least the direction where it's coming from, and then it's gone. Or it changes directions. And it messes up the project you're working on outside. It blows the seeds away that you're trying to plant. Whew, gone, just like that. But it's elusive. It's hard to understand and grasp the meaning of it. Several times in Ecclesiastes, the preacher sets hevel, breath, vapor, parallel to the expression, a chasing after the wind. You ever try to chase the wind? Maybe that word can be better translated, shepherding the wind. You ever tried to shepherd the wind? You cannot do it. You cannot do it. It's not the case that there is no meaning in life, and that is not the stance of Ecclesiastes and of the preacher, although many kind of think that. That is not the case at all. He does not think there is no meaning in life, though there are questions related to it. But rather, it's that life is that the meaning is enigmatic. It's elusive. It's hard to grab onto. Which leads to the preacher's question in verse 3. What does a man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? It's short. It's elusive. It's gone. What does a man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? The question. That's the burning question. What benefit is there to all this life's labor? If it's short, if it's elusive, if you cannot grab onto it, and therefore the things you do are short and ultimately elusive, and you really can't grab onto it. Listen, if we try to grab onto this life, it'll be ripped out of our hands at some point. And as Ecclesiastes, as the preacher goes on, he'll show us that in order to enjoy this life to the fullest, you've got to hang on to it with an open hand. With an open hand. Then you're in a position to benefit, to enjoy it. But I get ahead of myself, and I promised myself I would not get too far ahead of this to not let the cat out of the bag. So I've got to zip my mouth shut on that and move to this point. When Job loses all his children and all his property and wealth, remember that in the story of Job? The news comes to him. So the house fell on your kids while they were celebrating the special day, a birthday or something, and boom, they're all killed. And then he gets the word that all of his flocks have been stolen, and that's his wealth. He's a very wealthy man, but it's all gone in an instant. And he cries out to the Lord, or in Job 1 and verse 21, or he cries out, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. The Lord gives and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Now, Ecclesiastes could say that too. The Lord factors into his thoughts in there. Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. In Ecclesiastes 5 and verses 15 to 16, the preacher echoes this prospect for all of us. For all of us without exception. And as he came from his mother's womb, speaking of man, as he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. Ron Blue, if you've been through his series of teaching, likes to make this statement. Ever seen a hearse pulling a U-Haul? No, not at all. Shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. The Egyptian pharaohs used to try to pass this up. When they were buried with very significant things from their life to be with them for the afterlife. You know where they are now? They're either disintegrated, still in tombs someplace, or in a museum. It's not with them. wherever they are. He goes on to say in Ecclesiastes 5:16, this is a grievous evil. Just as he came, shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? The toil for what does not last. What cannot be grasped. And ultimately, what cannot be controlled. What gain? The word there refers to what's left over. After all is said and done with your life, what is left over for you to take with you beyond yourself? What remains? You can accumulate all the wealth in the world. Can you take any of that with you? No. You can have lots of friends and relationships in this life, geared to this life. Can you take those relationships with you when you die? No. Now, there's more to be said on that. But in terms of this life and relationships in this life, you cannot take those things with you as they are. They'll be stripped away. How about that house that you've worked so hard on? Or that new car that you bought? Or that garden that you enjoy planting? Gone. You can't take it with you. I can't take it with me. What gain is there in those things? What remains? It's a question he's going to be asking over and over and over again. And we need to get an answer to that of some kind. By all the hard labor, he says, that reflects the fallen world, the toil there. What he describes or how he phrases it leads us back to Genesis chapter 3. And the preacher will be echoing Genesis chapter 3 over and over and over again in this respect. Genesis 3:17 through 19, the Lord God says to Adam, after he's confronted Eve, and then he's confronted he's confronted Adam, confronts Eve, and he confronts the serpent and all of that, and actually begins not in the order I've just said, but he says to Adam, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. It's significant he doesn't curse Adam himself, but he curses the ground where he's to get his livelihood from. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain and toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles that shall bring forth for you. And I find that out every time I'm in the garden. Thorns and thistles coming up where they're not supposed to. They have a place, but not where I'm planting other things, right? By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread. Listen to this. Till you return to the ground, for out of it you are taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Toil and temporariness. There it is. All the hard labor in a fallen world. It's a fallen world. The preacher repeatedly alludes to this, as I mentioned. Romans 8, verses 20 to 21, Paul talks of creation in this way. He uses the term futility, which is one of the ways that the Old Testament Greek translation translates the word havel, the Hebrew word here. For the creation was subjected to futility, to havel. Not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in the hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. Now there's hope there in the New Testament on that. Ecclesiastes will point us to that hope. But it's in futility. In this life now, it is a life marked by futility in so many different areas. Because creation itself is subject to futility and its bondage to decay. It is life under the sun. Under the sun. It's a phrase that occurs over and over again in the book of Ecclesiastes. Some have said this is life totally devoid of God. Not quite right, because Ecclesiastes, in its considerations, God is in the mix, but it is life, this life, and the things that transpire it and under it, and he's trying to figure that out by his observation and by his reason. which is again under the sun. Life under the sun. What does a man gain or a woman gain by all the toil that he or she does in this life connected to these things that are here and now? Matthew 16:26, Jesus says, "For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul?" Every bit of this life is passing, and along with it, every effort and every accomplishment that is tied to this life. What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? The answer that the preacher gives here to what profit is there is nothing lasting. Verse 4, he begins a poem here which explains this and unfolds this in verses 4 through 11. Verse 4, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The earth is permanent, but you are not. Humans are not. The word order here of a generation goes and a generation comes actually places the emphasis not simply on the brevity of life, but on the cyclical nature of it, the monotony of it. Notice he doesn't say a generation comes and then goes. He says it goes and then comes. He wants us to note here, not only is it short, but it's cyclical. It's over and over and over again, the generations coming and going and passing. Verses 5 through 7, he begins to unpack this. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. So it begins and moves to the end, but then it's back at the beginning again, over and over and over again. There's an orderliness about it. That's a good thing in this world, isn't it? Isn't it good that the sun comes up every morning and that it goes down? There's reasons for that. Good. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north, and around goes the wind. And on its circuit, the wind returns. So there's a cyclical nature. There's a pattern to the winds as well. Over and over and over again. And that's a good thing, unless you're in the way of a hurricane or something like that. Verse 7. All streams run into the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. So there are rivers, there are streams that flow into the sea or into a lake. And it never gets all the way full. It runs and runs, and the water travels there and back at the beginning, and you get the whole process over and over and over again. Over and over and over again. Nature is continually repeating its cycles without a final achievement. There's a lot of activity on this world, which is lasting. But where is it going? What's it accomplishing? It's maintaining things kind of as they are. Verse 8, the preacher hooks this up with our mouth, with our eyes, with our hearing. Human action, he is saying, is no less repetitive without lasting achievement. Listen to what he says. All things are full of weariness. Why? A man cannot utter it. There's all of this here, we cannot explain this monotony here. Where is it going? Why is it here? The eye is not satisfied with the seeing. You can't gain it from your experience. Nor the ear filled with hearing. You're not going to hear somebody else explain it. Give the reason for it. Where it's going. To declare the end from the beginning. There's only one who does that. And what you hear, what you see, limited to this life, is not going to satisfy, not in the long run. Not your money, not your house, not your garden, not your spouse, not anything in this world will completely satisfy you. What has been, verse 9 says, is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new. It has been already in the ages before us. Human action is no less repetitive, and it too is out without lasting achievement. You say, well, man, I've seen people who have achieved a lot in their life, right? They've gained wealth. They've governed nations. They've conquered worlds. They've done this or that. They've invented things. Look at the technologies. Nothing like this ever. Oh, really? Really? When you think about it, all of this is building on the same things and accomplishing the same kinds of things that we're desiring to do. There's nothing fundamentally different about it. Nothing new by way of governments and wars, rumors of wars. We've had those all along. Nothing new in terms of inventions, in terms of you have the wheel and then a lot of variations on it. You have the calculations and things what the ancients could do and make. You've improved that with a computer and other things and created a lot more work for us as well with those things. But in terms of a fundamental advancement of us as human beings, we're the same as we always were, aren't we? History repeats itself over and over again. We only think things are new because we forget. Because we forget. Yeah, they're relatively new things in terms of variations. But not ultimately. Ultimately, human beings are stuck in the same rut. Stuck with the same sin problem. Stuck with the same evil. Stuck with the same life and death issues. Stuck with the same cycles over and over and over again. Seemingly not getting anywhere. It used to be thought, and this rises periodically, that the human race is advancing and progressing and becoming better and better. I don't see us as being any better than the Cain and Abel, where Cain killed his brother Abel, Havel. Why is he named Havel? Because his life was a breath. Don't kid yourself. We're not progressing as a race. It's a good thing that the world is consistent as it is, but we as human beings do not progress, at least not on our own. Generations come and generations go. People and their accomplishments are forgotten. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. The same part of the cycle. Forgetfulness is the same part of the cycle. You will not be remembered for anything 100 years, 200 years, 500 years from now, certainly 1,000 years from now if this life continues on as it is. How many of you remember the kings, great kings of Persia who ruled the world for several hundred years? I mean, you can look some of them up in names, but they're largely forgotten, unknown. How about those who ruled 6,000 years ago? Do you remember any of them? No. They didn't have writing at that time to be remembered. That's our destiny under the sun. That's our destiny in this life. Nothing is remembered, so it just appears that something is new. And it cries out, and this is where I want to conclude here with this. It cries out, and because this is where Ecclesiastes, where the preacher begins the search. He's laid it out for us now. Next week, he's going to be mugged by reality in the next chapter and a half. And we'll traipse with him. And we're going to go back and forth with him in the weeks ahead because he goes and you think he's going one way and then suddenly he drops back. Isn't that how we think and work through things anyhow? We're back and forth, back and forth. But in Ecclesiastes, there is a progression. toward the one who is the source and the goal of progress, true progress. But what we find here and throughout Ecclesiastes is a cry that we must look beyond ourselves and beyond this life for anything of ultimate satisfaction. You will not find it here. Not on its own terms, not in this life. We must look beyond ourselves and this life for any ultimate satisfaction. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 18 says it as, we look not to things that are seen, but to things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient. That's what Ecclesiastes is saying exactly. But the things that are unseen are eternal, and that's exactly what Ecclesiastes will say as well. As the preacher brings us along with him on his quest for the key to life, he will subtly and relentlessly drive home the point that the answer lies beyond our own observation and reasoning. His own process in that is telling us that with where he ends up. And at strategic moments, he points us to the one whose thoughts and ways are not ours and are higher than ours, and as high as the heavens are higher than the earth, than our own thoughts and ways. That's where he wants to lead us, but we've got to walk the path for him to get there in the way that he wants us to. It is a message that I believe is crucial for our own day. Because how much do we live according to the moment instead of for eternity? How much do we strive and toil to heap up and gain what is here today and gone tomorrow? As a neighbor of mine once said to me, not long before he died, years ago, there's got to be more to life than TV. The answer to Ecclesiastes is there is. But he wants us to go through the struggle to get there, to find it. So that we will be ingrained in us and it will change us. And we can share that wisdom with others. That wisdom is found in a person. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for this part of your word. We thank you that you moved the preacher to gather things, to gather proverbs, to gather words and ways of putting them in ways that, well, leaves loose ends just like there are loose ends in life. But they are words that ultimately come from you, the one shepherd. Words that ultimately will point to the good shepherd. And I pray, Father, that you will not let us miss the message. Help us to hang in there with the preacher, to get what he's trying to get across to us. And I pray, Father, that during this series, this course of time, in this part of your word, as we listen to your voice through this word, that you will enable us to live this life to the full with a view to the life to come. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.